Welcome to this episode of Safety Sisters, the podcast about the people who keep you safe at events and beyond. In this episode, I welcome Janthea Bridgen, CEO of Nipperbout, a company that provides mobile childcare and children's activities to the events industry for over 30 years. In this time, she has become established as a leading authority on best practice in childcare at events. We talk about how she got to where she is today, what it takes to provide best practice, and what challenges she faces in the industry. She shares fascinating insights on how she risk assesses events, debunks a theory that sometimes divides event safety teams, and what she would like to see change in 10 years' time. I learned so much from listening to Janthea and hope that you too can take home some of the wisdom she shares and how we can all work together to keep children safe at our events. I hope you enjoy. So welcome, Janthea. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on the Safety Sisters podcast as our second guest. It's such a pleasure to have you, and it's been such a pleasure just to have a chat with you before we started recording as well. So thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate it.
No, you're most welcome. It's going to be great fun, I'm sure.
Yeah, we're going to learn everything about, well, I won't keep the listeners. Briefly, I would love to hear from you. What do you do, Janthea, in the events industry?
Well, I guess the simplest way of putting it is I provide a whole variety of children's services that facilitate inclusivity and safety for families at events. So that's anything from event creches for children age naught right up to 17, stay and play areas where the parents stay while the children play. That's suitable for things like exhibitions or open events, outdoor events. We also provide activities and workshops for festival fields and whole festival fields. And we provide lost child and adult at risk points. Just recently, we've also started providing training in safeguarding at events, everything you need to know about children and events, lost child best practice, and communicating with children, which is called Mind Your Language.
Oh, I like that. That's clever. Wow. So you do a few things then.
Yeah, we do. Anything to do with children, just facilitating inclusivity and safety, really, for children.
And you've been in the events industry a while.
30 plus years, which shows my age, I know. But yeah, we started in 1992 and kind of fell into it really many years ago. So I started life as an actress. And when I had my daughter, I suddenly realized I needed to do something that earned a little bit more regular money. And so myself and another actress had a chat and said, why don't we set up a shopper's creche? And we happened to be in Wood Green, which is where I lived. So we phoned the local shopping centre and said, have you ever thought of having a creche in your shopping centre? And they went, well, actually, yes, we have. We've just had a meeting. Would you like to come and talk to us about it? And then we thought, oh, my God, what are we going to do? We don't know anything about children other than the fact that I happen to have a child. So we did some research and we went in, and cut a long story short, we rented a unit in Wood Green Shopping Centre and I kitted it out, and it was fabulous. The only problem was that we started it in the middle of the recession, and so we didn't do very well. However, during that time, another actress's husband, who was an event organiser, said to me, could you come and run a creche in a field for a big corporate party? And being actresses who kind of say yes we can to anything, we said yes we would, and off we went. And we ran this this creche, which would have given you an absolute nightmare because it was inside this huge bouncy inflatable clown that kept falling down, and we kept having to push it back up again to stop it kind of smothering the children. And while we were there, a chap who was running ride and drive events for Vauxhall, I think he was a fleet manager or something, and he said, oh, this is a great idea. Could you possibly come and do this for our fleet weekends in Millbrook? And we went, yeah, sure we can. And that's how we sort of realised there was another business. And again, my business partner went back into acting, and I started to do events, and particularly outdoor events, on my own. And it's sort of all snowballed from there, really. I was talking to you earlier. It was all chance, which I think a lot of people who are in events sort of fall into events. And certainly a lot of people in the acting business, because I also mentioned to you that over the years, I've met many people that I've worked with in a previous life who now run their own, you know, AV companies, lighting, building set, shell scheme providers, all of that many, many times. So I got into festivals because I was walking around Finsbury Park, pushing my daughter in her buggy, and she made friends with a very lovely little dark-haired girl, and I got chatting with the mum, who turned out to be Vince Power of Mean Fiddler's partner. And wow. She said to us, oh, you should come to FLAR and run the children's field at FLAR. So we started doing that, and then there was a festival, I don't know if you remember it, called the Phoenix Festival. Are you too young for that? It was quite a leery festival back in the day. It was. I have some stories about that festival. I think I told you I got held at knife point once in that festival field.
That's frightening.
They knew that I was a lady who had tickets, so they came to get a ticket because the Phoenix was a strange festival. It had one side of it was outside where the main festival was, so you could buy mm-hmm. a ticket to come into the sort of bit where we were, which was the green fields and the children's fields and drumming and various other things. But if you wanted to see the actual act, that was inside a very secure fence that was quite difficult to get into, except that crowds used to try and rush the fence and hurl themselves mm-hmm. over and run across to get into it. So it was quite an exciting festival to be.
Wow. Where was that? Is that London or somewhere in the
UK? No, it wasn't. I'm trying to remember. I've got a funny feeling it was somewhere in Warwickshire near, okay. Anybody listening might remember, but I think it was somewhere near Stratford-on-Avon.
Okay.
Yeah. Or Stow-on-the-Wold or somewhere like that. It was in the countryside. It was beautiful countryside.
And
it was
in this big, up there.
I can't even remember what the field was. But it was a very interesting time. We did it every year for about 5 or 6 years, I think, as well as FLAR. And we even did Glastonbury once in 1993. We ran the children's field there. We had a lot of festivals in the early days, and a lot of kind of very bizarre events. We did paint a plane for Christmas. So we ran a creche in a plane, which flew up and went all over the UK and came back again. And we did film launches. So we ran corporate parties for, we did Flubber and George of the Jungle. And I can't remember now, but we did lots of very bizarre events where I think people thought, this is something that we need childcare at. And at the time, I think there were only about three people around that were doing that kind of thing. And then gradually we started to do trade shows. We did a lot of trade shows. We used to do the autumn and spring fairs, international fairs, and we used to do the clothes show for the BBC and the good food show and the big bash. I don't know if you remember that. Mind you, that was more of a big exhibition for children. And then we did things like the boat show and the caravan show and the international motorcycle show, and we did loads, but it's very interesting how our work has changed over the years. We still get some quite bizarre events, but for example, we did the 100th centenary of the Salvation Army in the O2.
Wow.
And that was back in 2012. And that was a really interesting event. That was amazing event. People came from all over the world. We had about something getting on for 100 children that we looked after.
That's a lot of children.
It is. Oh, and another very bizarre event is the Saudi Arabian embassy. And there was a time, again, around early 2000s, I think it was, they had a private graduation ceremony for for anybody who'd taken a degree in the UK, the king would fly over. And he would also transport the families of everybody who'd got their graduation certificate.
Oh, wow.
And we used to do this, if anybody's listening from Excel, it was they were brilliant. Excel Centre and ourselves worked together for, I think it was about 3 years in a row doing this event. And we just had to cope with the children. They had to cope with the rest of it. But we had 400 children aged under 5 years old. And 90 of those, 90 were little babies.
Oh my goodness.
It was insane. And my gosh, the risk assessment for that, as you can imagine, was, we had the whole of, I think it was level 3 of the Excel Centre at the far end. And it was just, it was,
how did
it was
you
an
manage
amazing
that? How many staff did you have?
I think it was 80 something, 85 staff we had. And it was really interesting because there were all kinds of things happened with that, which is that I didn't know that the Arab calendar, who knew, is only 10 months. So when they were telling us that their children were 2, they actually weren't. So we were getting babies that we thought were 2, and the ratios changed for that. And they were actually a lot younger than that. So we needed more staff. So we ended up bringing the crew in and getting them holding babies. And it was brilliant, but it was very well organized, really.
Yeah.
Very well organized. We have, it was a bit like a military operation.
I can imagine. So did you sort of secure this level 3?
Oh, absolutely.
And it kind of put in these rigorous procedures of anyone coming in or out.
Yeah, absolutely. And we had, we had security on there as well. And we wristbanded, and we had, everybody was badged. So there were, animals under the sea, animals over the sea, circus performers. They all had badges with different symbols on, and they all went into different rooms that had a symbol on each room and all their, needs. So basically you just broke it down so that there were lots of different rooms up on that floor, which we then shell schemed off to create even smaller rooms. Mm-hmm. So each area was only about 25, 30 children. So that's the only way that you could do it. And then each childcare team operated in, in a particular room. It was fun. It was fun. We've had a lot of weird and wonderful things. And the other thing we've had is as I said to you before, we bump into people from events. And I was almost telling you this story before, and I forgot to finish it, but we were in the ICC, and we were having a walk around with this guy at the ICC, and it wasn't going as brilliantly, because that's one of my challenges, is that childcare used to be treated as sort of very second-class citizenry by event venues particularly. Anyway, we love the ICC, don't get me wrong, we work really well with them now, so this was like years and years ago, but we were walking around, and I can't even remember the man's name now. And he suddenly turned to my husband and he said, "Were you the king from across the sea?" And my husband went, "Yes, yes, I was." And the clients and I was the only one that had any kind of an idea what this was about, And it turns out they'd done panto together, many years before, and he'd been the stage manager of this pantomime that Steve had been in Lancashire or something. So after that, the meeting went really well, and everybody was, it was fine. We had what we wanted. It was great.
That's hilarious. That's so funny. God, it really is about, it is about what you know, but it is about who you know. But actually kind of teasing back to what you mentioned about the meeting not going great and not kind of focusing on the meeting, but just in general, as you said, being seen as second class citizens, being seen as not important. How, 30 years isn't a long time for this to change. I'm assuming it's changed.
Some places, yes. All the venues, the big venues, absolutely it has, without doubt, because we work with them frequently and they've become to respect what we do, understand what we do, understand how huge it is. And also, I think now I'm at a stage where I know a lot about events and a lot about childcare and children, having children at your event, there is so much. We've got a whole course in it now, and Luki Winuka at the Obstinist has a course that I've done for her too. And there's just so much that to think about with children that people still aren't getting. I mean, just risk assessing from a child's point of view, you know, what I say to organisers, get down on your knees and do it from knee height. So your eye level is at a completely different level. And think about how big your aisles are and how much shopping you've got when all your delegates are likely to have. So things like the Ideal Home Show, for example. So kids get bumped on the head, and you know, they go flying all over the place by all the bags that people are carrying if you're not careful.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things that just little tiny things, you know, abandoned children. People say, oh, we don't have children at our events. Yes, you do, because I can guarantee that somebody is likely to just leave one because you're not allowing them into your actual show. So some parent will go, oh, well, we'll just leave them playing on their PlayStation out here, and you'll have an 8-year-old in the hall. Or, you know, Lou told me a great story about how they found a 7-year-old in a hall at an event she was doing years ago. And this child had walked from the hotel where it had been left in the hotel room across the busy road and into the venue in the halls. And then you're left with a child. And if you aren't, you know, where are you going to go with that child? What are you going to do with that child? Are you going to take it to the organizer's office? Are you going to take it to security? And that used to be the thing. You take a child to security and you've got all kinds of risks there. Language, for one thing. Doors coming in and out, hot tea, coffee, electricity, you know, computers, all kinds of things, that risks that are involved. So children at events is a huge, huge subject. Mm. But yeah, to get back to your original question, which I will do eventually, I do tend to go off at tangents, apology. Yeah, it has changed for the better, and people are, particularly in the bigger venues, much more understanding. But we still work with some hotels that kind of think, oh, children don't matter, children are the last thing on their list. And in terms of working with us, it takes a while for them to realize that actually, you know, what we do is needs to be treated with respect, and we need to have our questions that we ask answered for the safety of not just our children, but the safety of the venue, and of course of the organisers of their event.
And why do you think that? I mean, did you ever get a sort of indication of why you were treated this way, and why it's still there's still remnants of it?
Because let's face it, childcare is probably the very last thing on a budget that will go in, and it's the very first thing that will be scratched off. Now, not everyone, but you know, we have to be realistic. It's an add-on, isn't it? It's something that it should be something, and I think people are becoming more aware of it now as something that will get families in, that is including all the whole family, that is enabling people to come to events. But it does very much depend on the event. And I think the organisers that booked us back in the sort of 90s, thank goodness, appreciated what we did, understood what we did was a benefit, and so supported us. And so that's why our relationship with the bigger venues changed so quickly, because we have clients like Unison, for example, which are a huge union, and the NASUT, and the NEU, which are the big teaching unions. So, you know, and they have huge amounts of money to spend. So they would go into a budget and just say, just do what Jampia says, whatever she wants, you know, she needs to get. And that was great. And I think once people have worked with us and they realise the level of health and safety and the level of attention to detail that we go to ensure that what we're providing is a safe, secure space for children, then the respect naturally comes. I think you have to see what we do to kind of totally understand it. And as I said, a lot of our clients, we're dealing with sort of, well, this year at the NEU conference in Harrogate, for example, we had 128 children. And at the Glasgow Scottish Exhibition Centre, we had 80-something children. So, you know, we deal with large amounts of children. So things have to be, they have to run like clockwork, and they have to be, because you're dealing with other people's children. So yeah, so it's a bit mixed. It has changed. It has got better, and in other places, particularly the new little venues, not so much.
Hmm. And I mean, you know, in that time, laws have changed. There's a whole host of compliance, you know, in this. So it's, I think, as you said, it's like, it's understanding what you do, because it's almost that there's an ignorance on, you know, the part of the venue or the event organizer actually not understanding
what's underneath the surface. Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that we always try to teach venues wherever we go and make it absolutely clear to them is, and to the organisers as well, is that if you have a childcare creche in your venue, or if you as the organiser are organising one, you must make sure that your creche provider either has an actual registration with whoever the relevant body is, depending whether you're in Scotland, Ireland, Wales, or England. In England, it's Ofsted. So you need a registration certificate, or you need, in England, you need an exemption letter. Now, in Scotland, Ireland, and Wales, you also get an exemption acknowledgement, but it's usually in the form of an email. But in England, you get an actual very formal letter, which is brilliant because you can put it up and display it for parents, which gives the parents a little bit of, you know, added reassurance that you've done your due diligence. But basically, the law says that if you're providing, and that's throughout the UK, not just England, if you're providing childcare for children under 8 years old on non-domestic premises for longer than 4 hours, 4 hours in England, but it depends on the age of the child in Scotland, Ireland, and Wales. So that would be 2 in Scotland, Ireland, and Wales, 2 hours for children under 3, 4 hours for children who are 3 and above. In England, I think it's just 3 hours now, just 4 hours for all children. But if you're providing childcare on non-domestic premises for children under 8 years for longer than 4 hours, you will need an exemption letter from either Ofsted or the other local authority. They're very easy to get. You just have to write to them and tell them. You're supposed to tell them 2 weeks before you run your creche. So your creche provider should be able to get you that. And the problem is that if they're not doing that, then they're likely to be negating their insurance, which means the bottom line is if anything went wrong, that could come back either on the venue or on the organizer. So it really is important.
Gosh.
And that has the laws, again, I won't go on and on about it because I do get very stressed about it all. These laws have changed over the years and supposedly to become less robust in England, but in actual fact, it's just made it more complicated and more difficult for people to understand. But they changed in 2008, and you can get a thing called a voluntary registration as well as an actual registration. But if anybody wants to know more about it, I always say I'm more than helpful to give free advice on the phone. So just phone me up and I'm more than happy to tell you. But the best people are Scotland, because in Scotland, you register and you get your bit of paper and it's not buildings linked. In Wales, Ireland and England, your registration is buildings linked. So you can only operate a creche in that building. And if you go into another building, you have to do it all over again. But in Scotland, you can go anywhere on the provision that you have a proviso that you have an inspection once a year. Now, a once a year inspection would be amazing for me because, as I said to you before, in 2004, I had 37 Ofsted inspections. And even now, I've had 4 already this year. And most schools will have little hissy fits if they think they're getting one a year or we just one every 4 years. But we have at least 3 or 4 every single year because of the nature of our business and the way we move around from building to building. So, going back to health and safety, because we get inspected so frequently, and we also get inspected by the organisers, health and safety people like Unison, for example, people like the NASUWT and the NEU, they give us health and safety inspections. And quite often, if we're in a particular county, the county will come and give us a health and safety inspection as well.
Wow.
So we get inspected and inspected and inspected.
That's incredible. That's definitely different to 30 years ago, I feel.
Well, yes and no, because
Okay.
as I said, with Ofsted back in 2000, we in 2004 we had 37 inspections because they used to inspect us every time we moved from one room in the NEC to another room in the NEC, which was just stupid.
Wow.
So that's why the law changed a little bit and made it 14 days instead of 6 days, because they got even Ofsted got sick of inspecting us.
Yeah.
So it has changed, but not necessarily for the better. And it's still, you know, it's still difficult. And when you go into Europe, that's a whole other thing, because we work in Europe quite a lot. So we have to get compliance, you know, in every country that we work in.
Wow.
But yeah.
And in addition to that compliance, are there any other sort of regulations about like your staff's qualifications and training in CPD in terms of their roles?
Absolutely, that's just standard. Absolutely, yeah. You have to have at least half your staff qualified. They all have to have DBS checks. Oh, that's something else that event organisers and venues need to know, which is that they should not be asking. Quite often I get asked to send copies of my staff's DBS checks. It is actually illegal to send a copy, either electronically or photocopy, of a DBS check. You shouldn't be doing it. And even because if I sent you an electronic copy of my DBS check, it would mean absolutely nothing anyway, because what you need is to see my face, my DBS check, and my supporting ID, either a passport or a photograph or driver's license. And the address on the driving license needs to match the address on the DBS certificate, and my date of birth and my name. And that those three things, my face, my DBS, and my ID, is what you need in front of me. Me just sending you a piece of paper is pointless. Could be anybody's. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. That's so interesting.
Basically, you know, if you've hired a decent question company, then they should have done their due diligence. But that's another reason why you need to hire a very regularly inspected question company like us, because you know that Ofsted or the health and safety people will have done that and will have asked for the proof.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so they all have to have DBS checks. They all have to be, you know, have first aid certificates. They all have to have, well, nowadays, lots of additional needs, because that's something that's hugely changed. Back in the 90s, early 90s, we would maybe have one child with special educational needs, maybe a year.
Mm-hmm.
Now we don't have a single event. I have not done an event, certainly in the last, you know, since COVID, that hasn't had at least one child with special education needs, if not more, which is quite worrying. And it had been increasing before COVID, but since COVID, it's huge, absolutely huge.
That's really interesting.
We did an event recently where we had six children who needed one-to-one care. So then on top of your normal amount of staff, you need one-to-one care for those six children. And quite often parents don't tell us about that. That's another challenge we have, because I don't know if they think that maybe we won't have the children if they tell us that there's an additional need. So sometimes we have children that we have not been informed we've got additional needs, and that's hugely unfair on the child, really, because as we know, events are quite anxious making places, because everybody's heightened, everybody's feeling a little anxious. And, you know, the children don't know us. They don't know each other. They don't know, they've never been to the venue. They're probably not sleeping in their own beds at night, because they're very often in hotels. Mm. So all of that is huge anxiety levels. And one of the things that I see as key in my role is to reduce that level of anxiety for everyone, but in particularly the children. Because the venue are going to be anxious because they don't know much about childcare, and they're worried that we might do something that's going to fall back on them. Then you've got the client who's also worried because they're having to deal with the whole event. And my mission is to take everything away from the client. So we deal with it all without hopefully bothering the client much at all. We have to reassure the venue. Then we have to reassure the parents, because they're giving us their most precious possessions to look after for however long it is. And then most importantly, we have to reassure the children and bring their anxiety levels down. So it's a big task. It's a big task.
Yeah, that is. And it's interesting that you bring this up, actually, because there's been a few kind of conversations in regarding like attending events and actually the anxiety that it brings adults, and just the very nature of conferences and events actually can be really overwhelming for all
of us. Absolutely.
And that actually it's always been overwhelming, but we've kind of just put up with it, whereas now we're starting to go, hold on, maybe, you know, nail biting and shaking and you know, all the other, I guess, physiological associations, maybe this is actually not very healthy for us collectively. So
and the problem is that it's catching, because if you've got an emotionally dysregulated adult, then, and you've got a perfectly regulated child, if you put them together within about 10, 15 minutes, you'll get a dysregulated child, because the child will pick up on the emotions of the adults. If you've got a dysregulated child supported by a regulated adult, then you're more likely to be able to help that child to get in control of and manage their emotions. And so that's what we always say to our staff, is try hard to leave your stuff outside the crash, so that when you come in, you're calm and you're regulated and you're able to support the children who, you know, have just got off buses or trains or planes in some instances. And their parents are all rushing because they want to go and get on with the event or the conference or whatever it is they're doing. It's a big part. Trying to keep everyone in a state of regulation is very hard.
I mean, you know, from my experience, that can be quite difficult for adults. So,
to do so. Absolutely.
Amazing to, hear just the level of depth that you go into, in terms of how you approach your role and the work that you do. It's really eye opening and very inspiring, actually.
Thank you.
So I, you know, moving on from, you know, how you got here to, you know, today and the challenges and that you're facing now. And as I mentioned in my question, as I accidentally put two words together one time when I got very, very fired up, but also inspired, passionate about some of the things I'm interested in. So I call it infired.
I think that's brilliant. It's brilliant.
So my question to you is what infires you?
I think anything to do with making children's lives better. And I think my big passion at the moment is the whole thing about lost children. So we've been dealing with lost children since, early 90s. And I think all those stories I was telling you about before, we learned a lot. We learned by, you know, by doing, really. So I, you know, in terms of learning and development, I think in the last 30 years, that's been huge for me and my team. And I think my key thing is, I've said to you before, you know, if you lose your wallet or you lose your phone in a shopping center or a museum or any public place currently, they will ask you to provide some ID. And they'll also ask you to sign for your wallet or your phone. And quite often they might even take your address and a telephone number, and they'll make you date and time. If you lose your child, very often, as long as the child is calling you mummy, well, even if it isn't, they will smile and just hand the child back. And that's what I'm passionate about changing. What I would like to see is, I'd like to see a law in place that says that anyone that is dealing with the reuniting of misplaced persons, be they adults at risk or be they children, there needs to be a proper, robust reuniting process. And the very minimum is that you need to be absolutely 100% sure that the person you are giving the child back to is legally able to take that child, is legally allowed to take that child. And you need to take a signature and a date and a time and an address at the very least, so that if anything does go wrong, there is something for the police to go on. And I know I've had organisers say to me, but you know, if the child's happy and they're calling the mum or dad, what's the problem? Well, the problem is, in this day and age, there are so many families that are, you know, split up, that may have care orders against them, where they're not supposed to, restraint orders, they're not supposed to be in touch with their families. And something like an outdoor event or a shopping centre is a brilliant place to reconnect with your child. And if you've been following them and you see that they've got lost and they've been taken to a lost child point, then that's the perfect opportunity to go back and try and claim them. And I'm talking from experience, as I said to you before, this has happened to me way, way back in, again, the early 90s. We were at an event where a man came and it wasn't a lost child point, it was a creche, but he tried to claim his daughter, produced a passport, argued that he was the legal guardian and that he had to have the child. And my member of staff handed the child over to him. Mother came back and said, he's not allowed to go anywhere near my child. He doesn't even live in this country. I didn't even know he was at this event. And you can imagine how scary that was. Fortunately, I'm trying to think where it was. I've got a feeling it was Olympia, but even back then they had great procedures for shutting everything down and they shut everything down and we managed to get that man and it was fine. But that made me, you know, right back then, and that was in a creche situation, which is why I then in a lost child situation am so super duper conscious of making sure. So, you know, very often that in a lost child situation, the person that is coming to collect the child will be the next door neighbour, or, you know, they've come to the event and they've brought their friend's child, or it'll be grandparents or sisters or, you know, relatives. But you have to phone up the actual legal guardian. You have to have security questions ready to ask them so you know that they actually are the parent of that child on, you know, over the phone. And then you have to ask their permission to give the child back to whoever they're with. Now, that is actually a law. So a child under 6 years old cannot be given, it's illegal to give a child under 6 years old back to anybody who is not their parent. But it's best practice to find out and make sure anyway. But under six, it is the law. So there's a lot of stuff around lost children that, you know, people aren't aware of. And so what I see is, you know, many security teams who do a great job, but they don't have all the knowledge that that they need to have really to be absolutely sure. And the other thing is it's about safeguarding the children after the event. So if you've got a situation where you might think, oh, you know, I'm not quite sure about that. This parent wasn't happy to sign anything. They weren't giving me the right questions. They just walked off. Then it's important to follow up on that. And again, as I said to you before, we now run training courses in how to robustly reunite children. And that's all, you know, that's all part of what we do. We've got a lot of very great procedures. But again, I'm always willing to give away information. So if anybody wants to phone me, they're more than welcome to.
Thank you. And so when you, one of the things you said was you, when you've got a lost child situation and someone comes to collect the child, you're ready with questions immediately that you say. And what kind of questions are you asking them?
Well, a very obvious one is when you've got a found child. Yeah. And that's the other thing. Language is really important. Quite often we call the whole process the lost child process. But when we're on the radio, we would refer to a child either as missing or found. And immediately that makes you know where the child is.
Yes.
And you also know how kind of proactive you need to be. Because if you've heard over the radio that there's a missing child, then you need to be extremely proactive. If you've heard that there's a found child, then it's not so difficult because you know it's with someone and they know the child's safe. And what you're looking for is a distressed parent or a distressed adult. Sorry, I forgot my question.
That's all right. Some of the questions you ask.
So as soon as you've got the found child with you, then you ask what we call the security question. And that can be anything from, do you have any pets? What's your granny's name? What school do you go to? Anything that the parent or the person that is genuinely collecting that adult will know. If the child can't speak, then there are other things that you can do. You can use items of clothing or things that the child maybe had with them when they arrived, that kind of thing. If the child's missing and the adult who comes to inform you that their child is missing, then again, you would ask the parent a question about the child. Obviously, you're going to ask them description, but you're also going to say, oh, can you tell me what your mum's maiden name is or whatever? So again, when the child arrives, you ask the child that question, what they call granny or what school they go to. And again, that's just it's a very quick, easy way. And that's something security staff can do, because quite often I get told, oh, but, you know, there's no time to do all this recording because they were only, you know, they were only separated for a minute. But a minute's all it takes. And just to say to the child very quickly, oh, what school do you go to? Or what's your granny's name? Or something like that. You can just ask the parent. So you've done something.
Yeah.
As I said, ideally, I'd like a signature and a time and a date and some ID checked. But I, you know, realistically, I know that these things happen very quickly. The other thing you can do is look on the phone, ask to see the phone. Now, if you ask to see pictures of the child from a few weeks ago, so not necessarily straight away and on that day, you need to make sure that they've had pictures on their phone of that child a few days ago. So you know that, you know, they have been with that child for a while. Then that's another really quick, easy way of making sure that you're giving the child back to the right person.
Yeah, it's really very simple, but very effective measures.
Yeah.
And with the last child process, as you know, we briefly discussed before, from my own perspective, I'm, you know, often, well, if I'm not doing transport or crowd management, working with, you know, security and stewarding staff or in event control. So all we hear is, you know, is just the info of missing child and here's the description of the child. And you said something very interesting about that, because we do have this sort of, is it interest? I don't know. Some events do, some events don't, but there is this sort of, you know, thing about coding and using code words over the radio, and yeah, just very interested to hear your take on that regarding the process.
Well, I just think it's nonsense, to be honest, because if your reuniting procedure is robust enough, then it really doesn't matter who hears you over the radio. Of course, you're not going to make a big announcement that some child's been lost, but to use words like Walt and Disney and all of this stuff, it just does, it wastes time. Also, if that information isn't properly disseminated, which it very often isn't, then your security guards don't know a Walt from a Disney, so they don't know what you're talking about anyway. So if you just say, you know, there's a missing child under the age of 5 wearing a Batman t-shirt, if Joe Bloggs does happen to hear it or hear that message over the radio, then the chances are they're going to help you. Because in actual fact, the more eyes you have on the ground looking for a small child in a Batman t-shirt, the more likely, the quicker you are to find that child. So, yeah, I mean, yes, there are predators around. But if everybody's looking and the security guards are looking, then it's highly unlikely that those predators are going to get that child, because your robust procedures will be in place and your whole lost child care policy will be that you aren't going to give a child without checking ID and without being 100% sure that that really is the right person. So, yeah, codes are, in my view, a total waste of time. Not IC codes. IC codes are great, because that's about respect and about, you know, that's personal kind of information. But just the fact that there's a lost child around, yeah, I don't see the point in keeping that quiet at all. No names, of course, and certainly not over any radios. But again, the other thing that you can do is you can put messages out to say, if you become separated, you know, in the event that you become separated, please go to the information desk or the lost child point or whatever. So you're just reminding people where to go, including children. And that's another thing. Quite often people try and hide the lost child point. You should hide it. That's insane. Because if you hide the lost child point, you're running around. People are running around not knowing where to go to report the fact that they've lost their child. And equally, you know, if you've got a lost child point with a great big flag saying lost children here, then teenagers, because they're the ones that most frequently get lost, to be honest, it's sort of anything from 10 up, they know where to come, so they come. But if you don't tell them and you try and hide it away, then you're just increasing the risk and the potential danger to the child, I think. Well, I don't think, I know.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, and in these, with making the last child point very obvious and with not using code words when describing the missing child, it's all it is, it's reducing the time that is, you know, because time is of the essence in these cases, isn't it?
Absolutely. And that's something else that everyone should do, in that, that, you know, you need to risk assess your venue and your environment so you can work out how long you're actually going to leave it before you call the police or involve the police. And you also have to take into consideration how long the child was missing before. So we, you know, we have a list of times, depending on what sort of environment we're in, that we adhere to. But, you know, quite often someone will come and say, oh, I can't find my daughter. She's about 13 and she was supposed to meet me here. And we say, well, how long ago was that? And they say, oh, it's about 2 hours ago. It's like, what? You know, so you have to take into consideration how long the child's been missing for, as well as so you know when you need to involve the police and how quickly you need to involve the police. And that also depends on the age of the child. So yeah, for a 13-year-old, you might not be calling the police immediately. But if the child is under three, or three, you know, you're going to be calling the police a lot more quickly, because the potential danger, and also if you're on a road or if you're near water, or there's all of those factors, risk assessing factors, that need to be taken into consideration when you're thinking about it.
And in you know, when you're planning the event, obviously you're building a relationship with the police. So is it I mean, obviously with the age of the child makes a very big difference of how quickly, but do you usually have sort of standard procedures that you benchmark off of when it comes to working with the police?
We have standard kind of set times depending on so what we do with our staff is we give them their chart, and the first thing they do when they get there is risk assess the environment, risk assess, you know, the escape routes, risk assess the potential dangers, risk assess the stakeholders, you know, make sure they've got all that information. I mean, another key thing is the kind of crime against children that is most prevalent in that year, that area. So for example, in Newham, where we work a lot, that has one of the highest rates of trafficked children in the UK. Lincolnshire has got the highest rate of I think it's county lines. An event we've just been working out has a very high instance of violence against children. So every area will have a different crime against children. And if you know what that is, and you've kind of raised the awareness with your team, then in terms of the reuniting process, your awareness is a little bit more heightened. So, you know, if I was working in Newham and someone said, oh, I came with my auntie, then I'd be going, okay, your auntie. How actually related is this auntie? Is it your mother's sister or your brother's sister, or is it actually just a family friend? And where do you live and what school do you go to? And I'd be asking a lot more questions so that I could find out whether that child was being trafficked or not, and be able to put some kind of protection in place if it was needed.
Wow. That's incredible.
Yeah, lost children is a huge thing, and quite often, you know, there's not enough understanding about the complexities of it around.
Yeah. I mean, even
so that.
Yeah. I mean, just, you know, me now, I not even understanding that to even, you know, in whatever area you're in, what is the actual crime statistic of that area? I mean, that's really profound. And just once again, really, I think everybody should, you know, I didn't know. Yeah. And I think everybody should know and
Absolutely.
Be aware of this.
I mean, another key thing people don't realize is quite often in their policy, their lost child policy, they say, oh, well, we don't include children over 12 or over 14. Well, the highest amount of missing children in the UK are aged between 14 and 17. So actually you're cutting out your most vulnerable section of children. And it's so easy to ask the police for pictures of missing children. I don't understand why shopping centres, for example, that's what we always say on our training courses, is that, you know, you need to liaise with your stakeholders, one of which are the police. And where do groups of children that are living on the street, or, you know, children who've been missing for ages, congregate? Quite often, you know, big parks, big events, and shopping centres. So for us persons on the security team, if they had pictures of missing children in their area up every day, when they're having a cup of tea, they see these faces. As they're going on their rounds, they might spot those faces. And how amazing would it be to be able to say to a parent who hasn't seen their child for like months, do you know what? I saw that child at 4 o'clock on Wednesday, so that child's still alive.
Mm.
What a gift would that be? You know, and what an even better gift if you spotted it, we're pretty sure it was, and you're able to get the police and get something, you know, down there and reunite the child with its parents. I mean, obviously, there's lots of other issues in there because the child might not want to be reunited with their parents. But, you know, it's just little things that I think if people knew about, they would be able to put in place that would help children, would help safeguard children.
Mm. And all of these things that you're sharing with me, has this come about from law and regulation, or come about from your own development in this work and your own best practice?
Absolutely, our own best practice. And that's one thing that I really want to see changed in 10 years from now. I want people to be trained, and I want people to, I want the law changed so that they know that they have got to obtain ID, a date, a time, and a signature at the very least. And there are no laws around lost children. There's nothing to protect them at the moment. And, you know, people are doing a great job. They, you know, nobody is going to be handing the child back. Well, not nobody, but, you know, majority of people wouldn't be doing it out of deliberation. It would be out of pure not understanding or not thinking about it. And that's why I think, certainly in public places, because the law that we have so far is that it is your duty to ensure that your services and activities have a regard to the safeguarding and well-being of children. That's what it actually says in the Children's Act 2004. It is your duty. And so, you know, things could come back on you. And if a child has been missing, that's another thing people don't realise, is that if anything happened to a child, the police generally go back 3 months. So, you know, you could have had that child in your lost child point at your event 3 or 4 weeks before a child was killed, for example.
Mm.
And how are you going to feel about that?
Mm.
That's why it's so important that we don't just hand children back willy-nilly. We have to be really, really robust and know that we can sleep easy at night and that we've done everything we possibly can.
Yeah. Yeah, that definitely, that's incredible, the disparity between the systems in place and your own, you know, striving for best practice, and how actually that needs to be supplanted onto the laws and regulation in place to actually take care of these children. Oh, thank you, Janthea. This was a real eye-opener for me, and I hope for everyone listening. I have a whole new perspective on safeguarding children, taking care of children at events. I'll never look at it the same way. And especially the one of the ones that really hit me was, wherever your event is, the sort of crime statistic in that area. So to tweak your, as you said, like your reuniting process, and to really kind of be aware and heighten your awareness in these certain areas of what to look out for, can mean, you know, a make or break in terms of safeguarding these children. So
absolutely.
Yeah. So no, thank you so much for your time. And
not at all.
It was a real pleasure to speak with you. And I wish you all the success in your striving for the law to change and to be robust and to actually be adequate and effective in taking care of children at events. And, you know, one of my own passions is laws and regulation around events, and actually there's just, it's very piecemeal at best, because the events industry hasn't really been approached as a unit. So, you know, maybe we might be working together one day, and if there was a more, you know, if one day there was a law that could actually kind of govern events in a holistic way that can take all these into account. But certainly, regardless of events, there's definitely a lot that needs to change in the law. And aren't we really lucky to have you as a cheerleader and a spokesperson and someone who cares so much to look after all these children that will be coming ahead of us. So thank you again, Janthea. It was such a pleasure.
You're most welcome. It's been a pleasure too. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review and follow the show for more episodes to come. If you would like to learn more about crowd safety and improving the events industry, you can visit my website and blog at isaymurphy.com.